This is Betty Turnell speaking for the Decatur Public Library. Today is October 23rd, 1986, and we are recording in the library boardroom. Our guest today is Mr. Edward J. Seymour, investment counselor and broker for the A.G. Edwards Company of Decatur. Mr. Seymour, how long have you lived in Decatur?
Well, I've been here since 1959, I suppose, if my arithmetic's right. What is that, about something over 35 mm-hmm. years? It's probably...
33.
Yeah, all right. So, would you like to talk about, you were talking about earlier about my family name, how
of
it
course,
came up.
Yes. I asked you remember if you had an association with the town of Seymour near Champaign.
Yeah, well, it's rather unusual. My dad came from a large French-Canadian family, and they moved down from Quebec, Canada, some years ago, before the turn of the century. And the family name was actually Simard, and they got tired of spelling it for people, and they decided to... use the English version, as they called it, and so they took on the name Seymour. And there was quite a large family, but oddly enough, when you're in Chicago, people don't think about you as being a native. They usually think somehow that you have a Jewish extraction, and wasn't until we came down here that we became old settlers. But anyway, I was raised in Chicago and had the usual provincialism that big city people have, that thinking that was the only place that mattered in the world until you got a bit older. And actually, it was only till I probably was enlisted in World War II that I opened my horizons a little bit. We can go into all sorts of experiences. My mother was a dedicated person. I had five brothers and sisters, and like the typical immigrant families, they were very dedicated to educating their children no matter what. And she made a lot of personal sacrifices to see that we at least got a good education, and I just happened to go to college by accident. I was working, and a good friend of mine met me on the streetcar one Friday night and said, "Well, you're going to college." This was in August, and I said, "Well, I don't think so. I don't have any money." And he said, "Well, I'll show you how to do it."
Oh.
And so he fixed me up with a job both at school and as a theater usher, and with a little help from relatives, I was able to start school.
And where was this? What school was it?
This is at Loyola University in Chicago.
Uh-huh.
And it was my first experience facing the Jesuits. I had been to a parochial high school that was more oriented toward sports. And when I faced the Jesuits, they were insisting that you must be... good in writing and speaking, and I'm afraid it hasn't always continued, but at least they made me very much aware of that. Somehow, after a year of adjustment, I was able to survive the Jesuits and didn't get drummed out of school.
Mm-hmm.
And shortly after that, I was... back in those days, we used to enlist so we could stay in college.
Now, this time was...
This was just prior to World War II.
Yes, right.
So it would have been in the, in the late 30s.
38.
Yeah, 38, 39. And so it's probably amazing to think on how, going back a minute, working as a theater usher, I made 25 cents an hour. Now, that's a ridiculous amount to think that she had a job that would help you go to school, but that and the work at school, I was able to pay my tuition and keep up.
And what course did you study at that time?
Well, all of us were a little bit nervous trying to position ourselves for the serving in the Army or the Air Force.
Or avoiding service.
Yeah. And I was, I had been in sciences, and I was, I started out as a chemistry major, and then decided that maybe I should be an engineer. So I was taking some courses at night at one of the engineering schools, which was Illinois Tech, and I even, all this happened in about three or four semesters before the Army finally called me. In fact, as they just, more or less one time, they gave us warning that they were going to call us in 6 months, and they just cleaned out the school. And it was sort of a fortunate time. We had about 100 of us, all from the same college, ended up in the same basic training, and they put us in the, after putting us through the routine Army basic, they put us in the Air Force. And
where did you do your basic training?
Oh, it was in Tampa, Florida, Tampa and St. Pete. And we had a camp there that was, we were in it about 2 months, and it was finally condemned because everybody became sick. And in good old Air Force style, they transferred us to a downtown hotel in St. Petersburg and made us do our training by going to the baseball parks where all the major leagues train. And so many people that are in the infantry never felt that was really a qualified basic, but we somehow survived.
And then were you assigned to duty?
Well, it seemed like in that period they were sort of, they decided that all the schools they were going to send us to were closed, and so they decided that they were going to give us another basic training. Mm-hmm.
Was this for officer training?
No, this is just basic training for enlisted men. Mm-hmm. But now you have the situation of about 100 college boys who have been through basic training, who are restless and are told they're going to have to do it again. Mm-hmm. And they made the mistake of assigning the people in charge of us were almost illiterates from Georgia. Mm-hmm. And they had trouble even calling the roll. And of course, this was a test of our ingenuity, how to avoid duty without getting court-martialed. And so we spent the next 6 months just trying to fool the cadre. I was supposed to be assigned as a link trainer instructor because of my background in science, and after sitting around for another couple of months, they finally decided that they had lost my records, and so they, in fact, as they lost several of them, so they said, and they just assigned us finally to the, it was called the Army Specialized Training Program, so they really sent us back to college again. And that was a fortunate experience, and then I went to Carnegie Tech, which is now Pittsburgh U. Mm-hmm. It was an excellent engineering college, and learned more math and science there than I had learned before. And had the experience of taking advanced calculus courses, and this man did a marvelous job of giving you a great deal of confidence about being able to handle these things.
Did you decide you might like to be an engineer?
Well, I had a problem with being an engineer. There seemed to be certain personality types that I had some problems with. And the people that seemed to enjoy solving problems by on their slide rule. And this seemed to, and I just had problem, had difficulty relating to those types of people. I felt, well, they were just plain dull, frankly. And so I stayed with engineering, partly because I came from an era where college was thought of as a way to get a good job. And so, unfortunately, we were in that college program for 9 months, and then the Army decided, well, they were preparing for the D-Day invasion. And they took all but, this was a school, there was about a contingent of about 1,000 of us at the Carnegie Tech. They took all but 20 of us. The great majority of those men went to the infantry and were in the D-Day invasion. Mm. And why the luck of the draw, why I got sent back to the Air Force, I'll never know. Mm-hmm. And several of my friends that I knew were didn't make it through the D-Day invasion. And, you know, looking back as an older person now, you think about what a waste that is. Mm-hmm. Because these are all fine young men. Mm-hmm. But again, I went back to the Air Force and was given more technical training, all sorts of schools. And the irony of it is then I was shipped overseas to India to fly the Hope.
Oh.
And you got the... The atmosphere overseas is much different than in the States. Everybody worries about your so-called records and what schools you've been to and what you're qualified to do, and you have an elaborate interview. But we got overseas, and the man said, I have two jobs. You can either drive a truck on the Lido Road, or you could go back on flying status. I got off flying status because I left my glasses one day off, and they said, well, come back tomorrow and we'll take the eye test with your glasses. Well, tomorrow never came because they shipped us out. And so my application went in the stack of people not qualified to fly. But then when I got overseas, they made great effort to see if I could fly again. Fact is, the doctor had a little trouble with color blindness. And the doctor was taking his eye charts and going out in the sun and saying, now can't you see that?
He wanted you to pass.
He wanted me to pass. And he said, well, you can really tell green from red. I said, sure. He says, well, you're qualified, no problem. So anyhow, I ended up on flying status and flew the Hope for about 18 months.
And was it as thrilling as it sounds?
Well, it was downright scary sometimes. We didn't get threatened by enemy action that much. It was mostly the weather, just being over the Hump. You had to fly through that whole monsoon season. And about the fifth trip, I remember this so well. I was. You know, when you get in a life-threatening situation, particularly when you're young, you begin to... I was in this airplane, and it was... This was a four-engine airplane, and we had full throttle trying to climb, and the plane was dropping at 3,000 feet a minute. And then the next minute, we were pointed downward, and it was going up. The winds were just so severe over the mountains that it was just tossing us around like a leaf. And we had radio communication between the pilot. I was the radio operator, and between the radio and the pilot didn't use the radio. He motioned for me to come up, and of course we're in these big suits with the oxygen masks because we're flying at altitude, something like 30,000 feet. And so he comes up and he takes his mask off and starts to talk to me, and he says that we don't break out in 5 minutes, I want you to start the Mayday. Mm-hmm. And Now, this is my fifth trip, see, and so I'm not exactly a seasoned veteran yet. And about the time I turn to go back to my seat, St. Elmo's fire breaks out on all the propellers. So here you have neon signs during the black of night, and these propellers, and then the static electricity dances along the wing and across the cockpit, and then disappears in a puff. So all this took just a split second, but I'm sure my face was white. I said to him, "What was that?" And he just said, "St. Elmo's fire, go back to your seat." But fortunately, we broke out, and he was a good navigator. And we were on course, despite all the buffeting, and got down safely.
What did you fly when you were flying the hump? Were you flying supplies or personnel, or why did you fly it?
Yeah, it was a very expensive operation, looking back on it. But we flew we used to fly gasoline and bombs to the bombers, the B-29s, that were staged in North, that were situated in North China. And so we hauled for several months to get those B-29s off the ground once. So the first raid from Tokyo was launched from China. And most of the time, we used to haul supplies once in a while. If they couldn't, most of the food came in on the Sausalito Road with trucks. But we were sometimes fortunate to get a load of beer. And what that meant is that we could, it's hard to believe, but the planes many times were stacked up in China as heavily as they were in Chicago Midway Airport. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways to get, after you're in the air a long time, you'd like to get down on the ground fairly quickly. And so it was a fortunate thing when you had a load of beer, because if you spell that out to the air controllers, they cleared you for landing.
No problem there.
So that was part of the fun of it. But I would say, I don't think most people are aware of this, one of the problems of being in service is it's just boring. Mm-hmm. There is so much waiting. And sure, you're in danger once in a while, but particularly when you're young, it's hard to handle the boredom. Well, we continued to do the usual things that you do in services, wait a great deal for things to happen. I guess when you get away from the military, I was never greatly in love with the military at any time, but one of the things that August 1st was Air Force Day. This was one of the things that particularly disgusted us, is that we were, the European armistice had been signed, and so there was just Japan, and this is August 1st, just before the surrender. But yet some general decides we have to put a certain amount of freight over the hump, mm-hmm. because it's Air Force Day and we're out to set a record. Mm-hmm. And in the northern part of flying of the Himalayas, there's Mount Everest. And if you take the northern route, which was actually marked unexplored on our maps, they knew the elevations were up around 29,000, but they didn't know much more about it. And so it was suggested that maybe if we wanted to get China and keep the freight going, that we ought to fly the northern routes. Well, as I said, it was August 1st, and we're up in the air, and all of a sudden we start to ice. Mm-hmm. And they didn't have the same devices they have today. We used to have an inflatable tube that would inflate the leading edge of the wing and knock off the ice. Well, the ice was forming so rapidly that the ice was forming in front of this expanding tube that we had. And of course, that changes the airfoil on the wing, and it's losing its lift. and so we're slipping down. And there's four ridges of the hump before you get to China, and it's not, you know, it's very high at the peaks, and it's virtually jungle at the river bottoms where they were. And so it wasn't the sort of thing that lend itself to jumping out too readily. And fortunately we broke out, and the ice started coming off as we started to go lower, and not knowing exactly where we're in the monsoon season where you can't see the peaks exactly. So we're dropping down, and fortunately the ice started breaking off and we made it in. But again, the old idea of somebody's trying to make a record for himself so he can get himself another star, and it was absolutely needless. I'm sure they had all that freight back out again at the end of the war, give it to the Chinese, which is probably what happened. But the whole experience in China was, China and India, you know, it just came, the idea came across of how far those countries were behind us. But I was always impressed with the dignity of many of the Indians, however. They had a great deal of personal poise that impressed me. But anyway, finally got out of the Army, went to the University of Illinois, and because of my engineering background, decided to enroll as an industrial engineer, only to find when I got over to the College of Commerce, they said, well, you have to take 2 years of the commerce courses and then we'll set up a curriculum for you. So anyway, I became an accounting major because I never got up over to do my curriculum for an industrial engineering, but I'd had a good bit of engineering courses, and all this, of course, helped me later when I was in the building business. Mm-hmm. But going from Illinois, then I interviewed several public accounting firms and ended up as working for a CPA firm in Chicago, and worked for them about a year and a half, and then left them. You might be interested in knowing about wages.
Yes, definitely.
I started on that job at $225 a month. Now, the big offer around that time was, if you went to work for Arthur Anderson, you might get $275. If you went to work for the government as an Internal Revenue agent, you would get $250 a month. And as it turns out, several of my classmates went with the Internal Revenue, and they were just starving for people because they had no top people because of the war. And those fellows went up to the, in a very short time, are making $4,500 a year. And I think I went from 225 to 250. All I knew so much about this, we were in the same building. But I was working with a small accounting firm and going back again. One of the accounts I was assigned to was a man that was, if you remember, how oleo was not permitted to be sold as a yellow
yes.
product.
You had a little capsule coloring and had to make it up.
The little capsule, yeah, I had an account, the man who had invented that capsule.
Oh.
And the trick was to get the capsule to dissolve when you massage the oleo, mm-hmm. so it would disappear. And it was interesting to talk to him. He had gotten out of the University of Illinois as a chemical engineer in the middle of the Depression, and could not get a job, and went to work as a broker on LaSalle Street, selling stocks and bonds, and then he did this his research in his basement, and came up with the capsule. And his problem...
Because he saw a need for it, just as a hobby?
Well, he was interested in many things. He was interested particularly in the area of plastics, which it's hard to believe that was a time where there weren't many plastics around. And because ultimately he worked on a plastic bottle for Coca-Cola. But his dilemma was that, of course, you got it, as I was suggesting, the whole idea of what you made is so different than today. But he, at that time, was going to make $200,000 in 1 year from his capsule patent. And of course, at that time, the government was going to take a good part of it. And our problem was to establish the fact that, but because he hadn't kept records of his early research in his basement, and because the IRS looked askance at that whole idea that you come up with expenses out of your basement, it was hard to establish, and it was unfortunate that they were taking a good part of his money. Well, that was just one of the early problems we had, and talk about changes. But this accounting firm were CPAs and attorneys, and I enjoyed working for them because it was sort of a hands-on kind of thing. You weren't. So I went from there. However, I had a job offer from a school supply company. Now, it wasn't just an ordinary school supply company. This was a firm called Weber Costello in Chicago Heights. And they needed a cost accountant. Now, they had never, oddly enough, this obscure company was making, had made the glow balls for the general staff in Washington and for Eisenhower that he used, that the whole group of generals used in the European invasion. Mm-hmm. And they had several Czechoslovakian immigrants that had the skill for doing exact map work on a glow ball. I never understood it fully.
I'm not exactly sure what a glow ball is.
You know, the world globe?
Oh yes.
Yeah.
Oh.
And of course, these maps that they worked on were huge.
Mm-hmm.
And during wartime, they were on a wartime budget.
Mm-hmm.
And would charge time and material. They would take a long time, and the work on these maps, of course, actually conduct the war, had to be very mm-hmm. accurate. And but suddenly what hit them is that one of the people that had worked there, his name was Rep Pogel, decided that you could make glow balls with plastic by just getting a machine to make a couple of plastic halves and punch them together mm-hmm. and get another machine to wrap the map around them, and you could turn these out inexpensively, and they were a big item for school children.
Mm-hmm.
Before that, Rand McNally had made a very careful map, and everything was done by hand. So we were in the process of coming up with something to compete with the competition.
Mm-hmm.
But and this plant made blackboards, and that whole process doesn't, anyway, I was brought in as a person to study the costs with the young engineer. But unfortunately, I was also working on I was taking a refresher course to pass a CPA certificate. And somewhere after, 3 or 4 months with this firm, I came down with polio.
Oh.
And that...
Oh, wait a minute. Where was this? Was this in Chicago?
Or yeah, I was living in Chicago, Chicago and actually living in the suburb of Homewood.
Well, that was a very great disaster at that time, wasn't it?
Yeah, a lot of people came down with it. Oddly enough, I trace my... I was at a church camp in Lake Geneva, And my daughter and two other small boys from this other family came down with polio. And I remember their mother calling me up. I was home, I thought, with the flu. And the mother called up and said, our two boys, we just took them to the Billings University of Chicago Hospital, and they have a slight touch of polio, and they have some involvement with their legs. But we think it's going to be okay, and I had no idea that I was involved at that time. And I was just, the symptoms were just very much like the flu. You didn't feel anything, except that I started to notice that when I raised my right hand I to comb my hair, I had trouble reaching the back of my head.
Mm.
And so anyway, my temperature wasn't very high, and I was just disgusted with laying around again, and so I went back to work, only to find that the temperature just really got high.
And you weren't under the care of a doctor then?
We had been in touch with them on the phone, but then
were you under the care of a doctor then?
Yes, as I said previously, I was in touch with him by phone, but when I ran this high temperature, then I went to see him, and he suggested that I probably was sick enough to stay in bed, and so he said, why don't you take a cab home? But instead I walked, and one wonders whether that was a critical walk, but shortly, in a few days, he came by to check me again, and then he said, I'm going to admit you to Billings Hospital for observation. That was the University of Chicago Hospital. And which I thought was odd, but anyway, he sent me down there, and the young intern came out when I got there, but they took me in by ambulance, and the young intern said, well, I don't think anything is wrong with you, you just need a good night's sleep. And I had been working fairly hard, in that I'd been taking a CPA refresher course, and plus working at the plant, and so I'd been going day and night. And but anyway, but fortunately, the head neurologist came down and said, "Let me take a look at him." And then he said, "Well, why don't we do a spinal tap?" And from that moment on, I didn't come out of the hospital for 6 months. But what happened is, they turned out that when they did the spinal tap, they apparently found the virus, the polio virus, in the spinal fluid, and decided to keep me. And I really got very, very seriously sick, and wasn't expected to live for a while. And that's sort of looking back, it's an interesting experience. Mm. Dying isn't nearly as scary as people might think. And it's funny, when you get so weak, I was so weak that I couldn't even lift my head, and that when they would turn me over on my face, I would get in a panic because I couldn't turn my head out of the pillow. And you know, you never realize when you get your foot in one position and you can't move it, it really, it's like getting a hot foot. It starts to burn. And you have to call for help just to move your foot. But anyway, going through that experience certainly made me overcome my fear of death, and realizing the problem is living, not dying. But it was an experience going through the rehabilitation in the hospital, because there were polios all around me, and some rather sad stories of there was a young woman who was had four children, and they pulled her through the polio, only to have her die of pneumonia in about a month.
And she was just a lovely lady, and her husband and the whole family, and it was just hard to take. But so that was the, and typically it was the struggle to rehabilitate that was, I suppose, good discipline. You get to the point where you realize there's no place to go but up, and that you just have to stay with your exercise, and sometimes it's your improvement is pretty feeble. I'm talking about such things as just being able to move a finger or something like that. And then, but it's funny, as you go on, it seems to improve in mass. You know, as the problem is with polio is that it destroys the nerve endings to the muscles. So that you maybe only have 15% of your muscle function, and but as you build it up, you could maybe build it back not to normal, but it may be to 30 to 50%. And of course, when you start out, it's very, very, very small. And so the it was basically the Sister Kenny approach, but it was in the hospitals by that time.
She used hot pads.
Well, the hot pads were mostly just for relieving of the. You get a great number of muscle spasms, and it's like having a Charlie horse or a injured muscle. You sometimes just ache all over from sore muscles. And this is when you just can't move. And so you go through a period of, you just have a great deal of aching muscles, and they use the hot pads that seem to relieve that. But it has nothing to do with really curing it. That's just for relief. And but all they did for me is, and most people, I still think the treatment is the same. They just keep you from getting something else because you're in such a weakened condition. And then as soon as you're able, they start you on the physical therapy to build the muscles back. But there's no, that's the only way they know to sort of retard the illness. So the polio vaccine is certainly an important thing for everybody to take.
And that came in?
Came in after, actually about 2 years. I've worked on the local March of Dimes, and I think it's certainly a good thing. I don't remember what you remember, but oh, probably 10, 12 years ago, we inoculated the whole town, and I think it cost everybody 50 cents or something, and then we had excess money, and we gave that to the hospital, as it turned out. But that was pretty much the story. It was I've sometimes felt that I could work with people who were disabled and discouraged, and I guess once you come through it, you realize that it's tedious work, but you do make progress. I don't do it in the same way that I did before, but I generally try to keep physically active, because again, going back where you only have limited muscle function, if you let go, you really go down. And the temptation is always to sit and not to function, because you get, I think I've read some studies now that polios, as particularly as they age, tend to get tired quicker than most people, and but I find if I keep a regular exercise program and I try to walk regularly, that it seems to keep my strength up.
Now, you'll have to help me a little bit with this sequence. Were you in Decatur or in Chicago when this happened?
I was in Chicago, and I was working after having worked for a CPA, I was working for this manufacturing concern. And then I couldn't see, that's the reason I came downstate. I couldn't function, excuse my voice today. I had to write the Illinois Central from Homewood, where I lived, which is in the south suburbs. And there was probably 50 steps to get up to the top of the platform. And I thought this was going to, and then to ride the mass transit, I just was not, at that time I had two leg braces and was part-time in a wheelchair. So it was just a...
impossible.
So I came to the old college town, which was Champaign, and got a job. Just went down to the Illinois Employment Service and saw the veterans representative, and he said, well, they want a woman bookkeeper on the west side of town for a construction company. Excuse me. And they, he said, you know what that means? That means they don't want to pay you much. And he said, but at that time I had two children, so he said, it'll at least keep you in groceries till you get something better.
And this was in Decatur?
This was in Champaign.
In Champaign.
So indeed I did come, and I went to this construction company, and they took me on. And they were building in the neighborhood of 12 to 14 houses a week, if you can imagine, mm-hmm. between Champaign and Rantoul. And they needed a business manager badly. And so I was brought in initially to start the bookkeeping organized, and then eventually I was indeed their business manager. And in 4 years' time, became a partner in the firm and spent another 4 years as a partner. And now, going back with the background of finance, always I had looked at even construction. I think one of the keys to being successful in the construction business is realizing that it's basically a finance-type business. You have to go from cash to cash, and the quicker you can do it, the better off you are, and control your costs. And there was a time when it might be interesting. I tried to buy a house from these people, and they wouldn't even take my money. They wouldn't even, they would take $50 deposits on lots, but they wouldn't even take that. They said, our list is too long, we have too many people that need housing.
Even though you were working for them?
Well, no, when I went to work for them, that was one of the conditions, because mm-hmm. I had to accept $50 a week, so I made another stipulation that they'd get me a house, mm-hmm. and they did. And but we bought a house at the outlandish price of, it's a three-bedroom house for $7,200.
Oh.
And the interest rate was something like 4.5%. And the monthly payments were $43 a month. Mm-hmm. So compared to the $50 a week in salary, I guess it wasn't all that bad. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't good. And along with that, we had two children. And then shortly after we were there, my wife had a set of twins. So then we had four children in a rather small house, and it took us about a year to feel like we outgrew that one. And after a time, I was admitted to a stock program in the company, and so we took the outlandish step of deciding to buy a bigger house for $12,400. And we were very worried because the monthly payments were going to be $100 a month. And so we did buy the bigger house, and in the short time I was a partner. And but then after I was working for this man for about 4 years, I then decided I wanted to go on my own. My income at that time was rather good. I can remember my father-in-law couldn't understand what I was doing. Here's a man on crutches with four children, leaving a responsible job and going on his own in the construction business. And fact is, he secretly met with my former boss and partner down in Florida, and they were trying to cook up something to get me to come back. But anyway, I then went with a partner and built houses in Belleville, Illinois, and we did that for about a year to 18 months.
Did you move there?
We moved there and built a number of houses, built about 50 houses. But Belleville was awfully near to East St. Louis, which is certainly a very difficult area. And my wife kept on saying to me, I don't know how we're going to raise these boys with this proximity to East St. Louis. And we now had, just before we left Urbana, we had another child. Mm-hmm. So we now have four boys and one daughter. Mm-hmm. And so she kept on bringing that up on a regular basis. And East St. Louis was really a slum area and very debilitated in many ways. So there was an opportunity. I was at a builder meeting, and I heard about the National Homes franchise opening up here in Decatur. So it was a cocktail party. I went up to the man and said, hey, I'd like to have that. And so we made the arrangements, and I moved back to Decatur. We like this part of the state, of course, better than... I like Belleville as a town. It was a wonderful town. But it was that problem of being so near to East St. Louis that bothered. So we came back and built the first house in about 1959. And then we bought a piece of land south of Muffley School. And after having plunged all the family savings in the land, the signal depot closed up, and times got rather rough for a while. And we were more than a little worried about what we were going to do, but we started out building houses, and we were selling houses with, say, 4.5% to 5% mortgages on them. And the prices were from like $12,000 to $15,000. And these houses were typically 1,000 square feet and maybe an attached garage. And that's what you got for that kind of price. That included the lot, incidentally.
Amazing.
And we had developed the ground. In other words, we took the piece of farm ground and put in the sewer and the water and the streets. And if you remember, that was a time when dear old John Deaver was here, and he was the first city manager that Decatur had, and he was a bit of the martinet. He was very strict on everything, and always in the city's favor. So we had a few go-arounds because I felt he was impinging on the private sector a little too much. And survived that experience, and actually our location next to Muffley School was very favorable, and we continued to prosper. Went from there to building eight different subdivisions in the city. I think I probably have built in that time probably something like 800 houses in Decatur and the Macon County area.
A great contribution.
I guess so. The then came the good old 70s. And it was you could see a changing pattern, which also relates to many other markets. We started to, in the early days, we were building what we felt was necessary housing. We were building housing for people that needed it. But then in the 70s, we felt we were building housing for speculators. It was people that bought the original house for $15,000, $16,000, sold it for $40,000 or $45,000, and decided they were brilliant real estate investors, and therefore they were going to now buy something for $60,000 or $70,000, and they would say things like, "Look here, Mom. Look what we made in that last house. Now, if we can just do the same on this $60,000 one, we can retire."
So they pushed the market up.
So that was, you found people were just seeking amenities all over the place, which I guess is part of the American dream, but it wasn't really a market of necessity anymore. You had older couples buying rather large houses, and maybe with one child left to leave the nest and that kind of thing. And of course, eventually we got the collapse toward the end of the decade. And always in times past, we had kept an inventory of land to interest rates go through the cycle about every 4 years or so. When interest rates went up, we always had some inexpensive land that we could get a government program going on. But this was a time when interest rates were going up and there was no government program. So that's when I decided that I was going to leave the business. I just didn't see how you could make any money plus sell any houses at 14-15% interest. And so I closed down my operation, and I still had some indebtedness to the bank, and I sat around for a while and thought I wasn't going to do anything, and then got bored with that and went to Chicago to see a friend of mine. Now, I had been a stock market investor ever since my college days, and had known people in the field. And so I worked very closely with Jim Oberweis, who was the man that I, he was the head of this firm. And I just went up and asked him for a job, and he thought I was kidding, and I said no. And so he put me in a crash course, and I became a broker in a matter of a month. Which was, fortunately, it was cold in Chicago, when I went through this crash course, we couldn't even go out. It was like 20 below. So it was conducive to just working. And fortunately, I passed the exam. That you go back to school again, but it comes around.
Good.
But let's see, what else did you?
No, was that with the present firm you're with, A.G. Edwards?
No, it was with Oberweis Securities in Chicago. I worked for them. We had made money together buying what's called small growth companies. And Jim Oberweis had his MBA from Chicago, and he studied under a couple of guys by the name of Sinkfield and the other man I forget. But they... they believe in the idea that if you invest in small growth companies, that over time you'll make more of a return than you will on any other investment, including real estate or anything else. It works very well in an upmarket. It doesn't work too good in a downmarket, particularly for the small investor. If you're well-to-do, that's good, but you have a staying power, but the small investor doesn't. But anyway, I was able, through what I had made in the stock market, to pay all the banks off. And so I was able to salvage my my building business and get all the, I had the indebtedness I had was mostly on the land, and I was able to pay that off and own my land free and clear. So that's been the experience up there. And what I was doing, I was still living in Decatur, but I was driving to Chicago every weekend. And then I was living with a sister up there who was about an hour's commute every day. So I was spending about 16, 18 hours in my car every week, which got to be a bit old. So I decided that it was much easier to come down here and work for Edwards. Did that about 4 years ago.
Have you noticed any big changes or any perceptible changes in the, what you call this personal finance business that you're in, the investment business?
Oh yeah, sure. I think, the advent of the discounter, and with the so-called deregulation, the banks are getting into our business and we're getting into their business. One of the principal changes that happened probably about 7-8 years ago is that stock brokerage houses got into the insurance business, and it made the insurance companies be competitive for the first time. In other words, they had to start paying a competitive rate of interest on their insurance policies, which they hadn't done before. Up till about 1980, they were only paying about 4% on cash values. And of course, when the rates went much, much higher, they had to revise, and then from the competition of brokerage houses, tend to look at insurance as another investment. In other words, there's the two parts. One is the cash value, and the other is the risk, the death risk. And so they came up with products that were very competitive, and the insurance company had to adjust.
But there have been other entries, hadn't there, such as Sears and other places that are entering into various forms of finance and giving a little competition to banks and insurance companies and so on?
Yeah, that's true. And of course, one wonders whether there's going to be a shakeout in time, because I think what you find is just like so many markets, when it becomes a very, very popular thing, it's sometimes the end of the cycle. Now, that may sound a bit cynical, and I'm not saying that because I'm a broker and we're threatened. I think we have a function in that our job is to provide advice and not merely be order takers. And I think if we do that adequately and do really what people want, plus lead them a little, I think we really need to lead them, that we can maintain our position. But it does concern me. It does concern me even with the stock brokerage firms. They're bringing on many, many young people who do not have much experience with investing money. There's one thing to learn it out of a textbook, and there's another thing to do it successfully. And as particularly now, you know, we have a great deal of volatility in the markets, and somebody said so well, if you think you know the market, wait till tomorrow and you'll be humbled. And it's that awareness, I think, that little perspective helps. But there, Okay, as to the future, I think there's some marvelous opportunities in financial assets. And some are saying even that it's the opportunity of a lifetime that won't come again. But we're going through a favorable time, and I know it's very scary, but we're going through this deflationary period, and companies that can function in it and still maintain some profits will come out very well.
Well, I think you should you probably look back, feel that you've done a great public service, first in the construction business, because people certainly need homes, and then nothing is more vital than the protection of finance and money to people. So really, I do believe that the fields you have been in have been those that have contributed a great deal to public service.
Yeah, it's, well, I suppose one does the public service by seeking his own ends, and I certainly wanted to be a responsible builder, you do, when you're in business, you do have to keep the concentration on the bottom line, otherwise you're just not there, and but I do think that, you know, I think most people, actually I would say this, and that many people in business are, and it's a curious thing about the American public, they think if you're successful in business, you're somehow been dishonest. And I don't really believe that's true. I think many business people are more honest than the general public. One of the delightful things in business is when you have an associate or a supplier or just anybody you're working with that you can really trust, and you can negotiate contracts, sizable ones, over the phone without going to all the trouble of drawing up
red tape
contracts. Yeah, drawing up elaborate contracts as a lawyer would tell you to do. But, you know, there are people that...
The old days when a man's word was his bond.
Yes, and that's still around. Mm-hmm. That's still around. And really to function quickly, and this was certainly true in the construction business, that you had to depend on that. And you can get a lot done when you have that working relationship.
Well, you have certainly seen a great change then in the construction business and the finance business in general indicator. What do you think about the future of Decatur?
Well, this isn't too concrete, but this is a feeling I have about all markets. When they're down, they eventually come back, and they probably come back faster than people think. And we always have a tendency to get emotional about things when they're at one end or the other. Either we become too optimistic when they're near the top, or we become too pessimistic when they're near the bottom. And that's easier said than done, but I think it's something to keep in mind. And